Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Anthony Brooks is off today. Slings and arrows between GOP frontrunners Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney. That is how the week began. But it ended somewhat agreeably last night in Iowa in the final presidential primary debate of the year, where Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney largely ignored each other. But other candidates did not ignore them. Here's Michelle Bachmann, no holds barred in her criticism of the fact that Newt Gingrich took money from mortgage giant Freddie Mac.
You don't need to be within the technical definition of being a lobbyist to still be influence peddling with senior Republicans in Washington, D.C. to get them to do your bidding. And the bidding was to keep this grandiose scam of Freddie Mac going. That is something that our nominee can't stand for.
Well, we're going to dive into the debate now and all presidential primary politics with our Week in Review panel. Joining us is James Pindle. He's political director for WMUR-TV in New Hampshire, but he's here in our studio today. Welcome to Radio Boston's Boston studio, James.
Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. Also with us is Kyle Chaney. He's a reporter for the Statehouse News Service. He's on Beacon Hill. Hey there, Kyle.
Meghna.
Great to have you back as well. So let's start right there with last night's debate in Iowa. James, after some sniping between Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich over the past week, suddenly last night they were very hands-off with each other. Romney, in fact, pretty much refused to take bait, even when Fox News' Chris Wallace laid it out for him. Let's listen.
Governor Romney, I'm going to begin with you. Speaker Gingrich says that you should give back the millions of dollars you made, in his words, bankrupting companies and laying off employees. You respond that he has, in your words, an extraordinary lack of understanding of how the economy works. What do you think of what Speaker Gingrich had to say about you, and are you vulnerable to that kind of attack?
I think it's a great opportunity for us, because I think the president is going to level the same attack. He's going to go after me and say, you know, in businesses that you've invested in, they didn't all succeed. Some failed. Some laid people off. And he'll be absolutely right. But if you look at all the businesses we invested in, over 100 different businesses, they added tens of thousands of jobs.
So, James, rather than engaging on the Gingrich attack, Mitt Romney pivots towards President Obama. What do you make of that?
This is an opening salvo of what we're going to hear from Mitt Romney if he is the Republican presidential nominee throughout the general election. I mean, look, last night had all the markings to be an epic debate. This is the last debate before the Iowa caucuses. For some of these candidates, Michelle Bachmann, Rick Santorum, possibly even Rick Perry, this is their last debate period. So if they could not leave anything on the table, they had to go all out on some of these folks, particularly Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich. And Ron Paul has been running hundreds of thousands of dollars of television ads in New Hampshire and in Iowa slamming Newt Gingrich. We didn't have any of that epic moments. In fact, we want to say that, you know, we're just a couple of 20 days away from the Iowa caucuses and they're racing to the finish, but that just isn't accurate. They're more like slumping.
Kyle, your thoughts on last night's debate?
Well, you know, I'm sure that Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich are happy to let sort of some of the second-tier candidates make some of the attacks for them. I think they would love to think of this as a two-person race now between the two of them. Although Ron Paul is, you know, as James said, putting a lot of money into the early states. So I think that explains that dynamic a little bit. Is that particularly Romney was happy to let Michelle Bachmann, you know, go right after Gingrich, and so he didn't have to get his hands dirty doing that himself.
Mm. James, do you think that some of the calm tenor between Newt and Mitt and Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich last night was because, for example, just yesterday, I believe there was that Rasmussen poll that for the first time had Mitt Romney edging out the pack a little bit in Iowa?
Well, it was that Newt Gingrich was basically just narrowly edging out the pack, and that Ron Paul was in second place, just 1 point back. And then Mitt Romney had been coming into third very strongly. Look, Iowa is wide open for any number of these candidates. And there is history lessons throughout several different primary cycles where the candidates that go negative in a multi-candidate primary system, which is what this is, they are they get hit for that. They get punished for going negative. So, but this was a stage for Rick Santorum and Michelle Bachmann, who just the day earlier at a anti-abortion segment with Mike Huckabee went negative hardcore mm-hmm. on Newt Gingrich. And they just did not do that in this type of forum. And it was their closing argument and possibly their last argument.
But we should point out, though, that Mitt Romney didn't escape all challenge. I mean, he did receive some questions about his conservative principles, particularly on social issues. For example, whether his move to the right on things like gay marriage and gun control and abortion, whether those are based on principles or politics. So let's listen.
I am firmly in support of people not being discriminated against based upon their sexual orientation. At the same time, I oppose same-sex marriage. That's been my position from the beginning. With regards to abortion, I changed my mind. With regards to abortion, I had the experience of coming into office, running for governor, saying, you know, I'm going to keep the laws as they exist in the state. And they were pro-choice laws, so effectively I was pro-choice. Then I had a bill come to my desk that didn't just keep the laws as they were, but that would have created new embryos for the purpose of destroying them. I studied it in some depth and concluded I simply could not sign on to take human life. I vetoed that bill. I went to the Boston Globe. I described for them why I am pro-life. Every decision I took as governor was taken on the side of life. I am firmly pro-life. I've learned over time.
Okay, Kyle, so I suppose to Mitt Romney laying it out that way makes sense to him, but maybe average voters just come out of that cut and think, what does he stand for? I mean, so much of his record is here in Massachusetts. What do you hear in that cut?
Well, you know, it fits into the narrative about him that he has changed positions on a number of issues. And I think, you know, you see him get frustrated when those charges get leveled against him. And I think, you know, he you know, in some ways rightfully points out that he's not the only candidate to have switched positions on some important issues too. And so I think it's just because the narrative about him happens to be that he's I guess flip-flopped on a number of core issues, especially social issues, those charges are going to be leveled against him throughout this campaign, and if he wins the primary in the general as well.
James Pindall, I just want to ask you one quick thing, because this week also there was a Suffolk University poll, right? And in the poll, one of the questions was, what words best describe these candidates? And for Mitt Romney, businesslike and flip-flopper were the top two, and these are amongst New Hampshire voters.
That's right. Of course, he still had the lead in that particular one. In that segment, you remember there's an old adage in politics that when you're explaining, you're losing. And he had a very strong debate except for that part. And of course, there's a little bit of inside baseball here. He had a recent Fox interview that he was complaining about on questions that were lobbed to him about being a flip-flopper. They were trying to see if they can get him a little upset. They were trying to go for one of those great debate moments. It didn't happen, but it was not a good moment for Governor Romney.
So, James, take us into the minds of the Granite State voters. How do you think last night's debate may have played with, say, independents in New Hampshire?
You know, independent voters, from what we know, really are still not paying all that much attention. They are going to be very motivated at the end about the choices that they have. And right now in the state, they basically have four choices between Newt Gingrich, Mitt Romney, Ron Paul, and John Huntsman. And John Huntsman, if he's going to have any play at all, he needs to go big time on these independent voters. Yet he's not reaching them. He's not even on the airwaves. Mitt Romney looks to be in a very good position to win the state. The question is, by how much, and is it good enough?
So let's move on a little bit to the major news that unfolded here in Massachusetts, and that is the significant developments for the future of casino gambling in the Bay State. Governor Deval Patrick appointed Stephen Crosby, he's a Republican with a long history in politics, academics, and business, to head the state's new gambling commission. The one thing that Stephen Crosby doesn't seem to have so much experience, though, is gambling.
I've had an occasional scratch ticket. I've gone with my stepdaughter and family to casinos in Cripple Creek, Colorado. And beyond that, no.
Kyle, I have to say, I'm not even sure I know where Cripple Creek, Colorado is. But Crosby isn't a stranger at all to the State House. What do you make of the appointment?
He, you know, you can't overstate how significant that position is, the chair of the Gaming Commission. That person sets the agenda for the future of gambling in Massachusetts. That commission is going to determine who gets to build a casino, how it operates, that it complies with the law. They're going to collect the taxes that the state's going to reap from casino gambling. So the appointment of a chair, it's a necessary first step, but it's also an incredibly important step for that, you know, setting the tone. I think Governor Patrick sort of muted some potential criticism by picking a guy who I don't think he's actually a Republican. I think, you know, he's worked for Republican administrations.
Right, for the Swift and Cialucci administrations. Right.
Right, exactly. And I think he's unenrolled, but because he's aligned himself with the Republicans in the past, it muted some of the criticism. And he is a guy who's been somewhat visible up here doing some work with Governor Patrick on various issues and seems to be pretty well respected inside the building. The question is, does it carry over, and do people outside the building also see him as someone with integrity and unquestioned integrity.
Mm. Well, he's the first and key person to be named to the commission. I believe four others will be chosen, or three others.
It's four others. The attorney general and the treasurer get to pick one each, and then all three—the governor, attorney general, and treasurer—will combine to pick the other two members. That's a process that could take a couple of months. They've got a search firm helping out with a couple of those picks. And so there's still a long way to go to get the commission whole, but the chair, again, will set the agenda for that commission, so it's a pretty significant move.
Hmm. Well, meanwhile, the Suffolk Downs versus Foxborough Casino showdown is not going to wait for the Gaming Commission. Both groups have already shared visions with the public, and billionaire casino mogul Steve Wynn, he's the one who wants to build a casino in Foxborough alongside Gillette Stadium there. And Steve Wynn says his vision isn't exactly a Vegas or a China of casinos. He wants something different for Foxborough.
To put a word to it, if those places are grand or vast or something like that, think of the word intimate for me. I think that this is a place that I would make feel intimate.
So, Kyle, let me just ask you one more question about the Steve Wynn issue. He says that building a casino in Foxborough would bring $10 million in annual tax revenues to the town. What do you think about the way he's pitching it to residents of Foxborough?
Yeah, I think that's sort of a necessary way to pitch it, because if the gut reaction in Foxborough, which as we've seen has been sort of, hold on, do we want a casino coming here? I think he's got to. His job is going to be to sort of convince them of the upside, and that is one of the potential legitimate upside is that the communities that host casinos will reap substantial revenue. They also have pots of money set aside for host communities in under the law to offset potential negative consequences of increased traffic and other environmental or crime issues that stem from casinos.
Hmm. James Pindle, let me ask you, do you actually live in Massachusetts, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, so you're familiar with what's going on here with the casinos. I mean, politics does play such a huge role into this because, we had a big fight on Beacon Hill for years to get the bill this far. Now it's signed into law. I mean, what's your take?
Look, here's what happened this week. New Hampshire's been debating their own gambling proposals. And let's leave aside Nevada for a second, but other states that have allowed casinos or have more expanded gambling measures, Indiana, Delaware, Pennsylvania. These interests is another layer in terms of the shift in power for state politics. So what we saw today in the creation of this commission is proof in the beginning to understand where the new power base is going to be. I mean, for example, in some of these states, we every year when it comes to the budget time, these gambling interests say, well, you know what? We got to cut the share that goes to the state, or we're going to move away. We're going to move away. It's this constant game of lobbyists, of big money. It's another source of power alongside with unions, alongside with business interests that may be a permanent part of Massachusetts political culture now.
Well, in the last couple minutes that we have today, it's time for our weekly hubbub, and those are the stories that didn't make it to this table or maybe even above the fold. So, Kyle, your hubbub.
As we speak right now, Governor Patrick is off in Paris celebrating his wife's 60th birthday. So it's a sort of a romantic getaway for the first couple. But the governor meant for it to be a surprise, and as we learned this week, he was a little too quick to hit the send button on an email that accidentally included the flight itinerary to his wife. So he ruined the surprise, but they kept their plans, needless to say.
Technology and its discontents. How many of us have actually accidentally pressed send when we knew we shouldn't?
I think Google
have.
Has like Gmail has like a 5-second rollback period where you can cancel. So it's important sometimes.
James, your hubbub?
Look, as we head to the holidays, I don't know if anyone's going to have relatives that are college-age girls involved or high school girls, but we saw a study this week talking about a new voice inflection that almost 60% of college girls have called vocal fry. And this is not the way that it ends on a high note, like, would you give me a hamburger? This is the one that is more sarcastic and grovelly, like, oh, I'll take a hamburger. And so I didn't really notice that was being a development. This is a new term for me, but I'll be watching out for it when we meet with the family.
Vocal fry.
Vocal fry.
Wow. You learn something new every day here at Radio Boston. Well, my hubbub is on a slightly more serious note, but I'm not quite sure how practical, and that is that the National Transportation Safety Board, for the first time ever, recommended a national ban on cell phone use while driving. There's been, of course, you know, lots of news frequently about accidents happening at the hands of car operators who are either on the phone or texting. This is the first time, though, that a federal board has actually recommended a nationwide ban. Lots of debate on whether or not that's practical. Kyle, the reason why I wanted to pick this is because I was covering transportation when Massachusetts first started considering its texting ban a couple years ago. And I remember in the early hearings on Beacon Hill about the bill, the distinguishing feature was that just about everybody was on the phone at the time. And in fact, one legislator was late, but he texted in from his car that he was going to be late to the meeting. So habits may be tough to break.
Absolutely.
Kyle Chaney is a reporter for the State House News Service. Always great to have you, Kyle.
Thanks, Magna.
And James Pindle, political director for WMUR-TV. No rest for you. January 10th is right around the corner.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much.